Chapter 38. And the maid lost credit every day. Charles marched on Paris, which was opposed to him, and attacked the suburb of Saint-Honor. In his fight, being again struck down into the ditch, she was abandoned by the whole army. She lay unaided among a heap of dead, and crawled out how she could. Then, some of her believers went over to an opposition maid, Catherine of La Roche, who said she was inspired to tell where there were treasures of buried money, though she never did, and then Joan accidentally broke the old sword, and others said that her power was broken with it. Finally, at the siege of Compiègne, held by the Duke of Burgundy, where she did valiant service, she was basely left alone in a retreat, though facing about and fighting to the last, and an archer pulled her off her horse. Oh, the uproar that was made, and the thanksgivings that were sung, about the capture of this one poor country girl. Oh, the way in which she was demanded to be tried for sorcery and heresy, and anything else you like, by the Inquisitor General of France, and by this great man, and by that great man, until it is wearisome to think of. She was bought at last by the Bishop of Beauvais for 10,000 francs, and was shut up in her narrow prison. Plain Joan of Arc again, and Maid of Orleans no more. I should never have done, if I were to tell you, how they had Joan out to examine her, and cross-examine her, and re-examine her, and worry her into saying anything and everything, and how all sorts of scholars and doctors bestowed their utmost tediousness upon her. 16 times she was brought out and shut up again, and worried, and entrapped, and argued with, until she was heartsick of the dreary business. On the last occasion of this kind she was brought into a burial place at Rouen, dismally decorated with a scaffold, and a stake and faggots, and the executioner, and a pulpit with a friar there, and an awful sermon ready. It is very affecting to know that even at that pass the poor girl honored the mean vermin of a king, who had so used her for his purposes, and so abandoned her, and that while she had been regardless of reproaches heaped upon herself, she spoke out courageously for him. It was natural in one so young to hold to life. To save her life, she signed a declaration prepared for her, signed it with a cross, for she couldn't write that all her visions and voices had come from the devil. Upon her recanting the past, and protesting that she would never wear a man's dress in future, she was condemned to imprisonment for life, on the bread of sorrow and the water of affliction. Apostrophe, but, on the bread of sorrow and the water of affliction, the visions and the voices soon returned. It was quite natural that they should do so, for that kind of disease is much aggravated by fasting, loneliness, and anxiety of mind. It was not only got out of Joan that she considered herself inspired again, but she was taken in a man's dress, which had been left, to entrap her in her prison, and which she put on, in her solitude. Perhaps, in remembrance of her past glories, perhaps, because the imaginary voices told her. For this relapse into the sorcery and heresy, and anything else you like, she was sentenced to be burnt to death. And, in the marketplace of Rouen, in the hideous dress which the monks had invented for such spectacles, with priests and bishops sitting in a gallery looking on, though some had the Christian grace to go away, unable to endure the infamous scene, this shrieking girl last seen amidst the smoke and fire, holding a crucifix between her hands, last heard, calling upon Christ, was burnt to ashes. They threw her ashes into the River Seine, but they will rise against her murderers on the last day. From the moment of her capture, neither the French king nor one single man in all his court raised a finger to save her. It is no defense of them, that they may have never really believed in her, or that they may have won her victories by their skill and bravery. The more they pretended to believe in her, the more they had caused her to believe in herself, and she had ever been true to them, ever brave, ever nobly devoted. But it is no wonder that they, who were in all things false to themselves, false to one another, false to their country, false to heaven, false to earth, should be monsters of ingratitude and treachery to a helpless peasant girl. In the picturesque old town of Rouen, where weeds and grass grow high on the cathedral towers, and the venerable Norman streets are still warm in the blessed sunlight, though the monkish fires that once gleamed horribly upon them have long grown cold, there is a statue of Joan of Arc, in the scene of her last agony, the square to which she has given its present name. I know some statues of modern times even in the world's metropolis, I think which commemorate less constancy, less earnestness, smaller claims upon the world's attention, and much greater impostors. Part the third, bad deeds seldom prosper, happily for mankind, and the English cause gained no advantage from the cruel death of Joan of Arc. For a long time, the war went heavily on. The Duke of Bedford died, the alliance with the Duke of Burgundy was broken, and Lord Talbot became a great general on the English side in France. But, two of the consequences of wars are, famine because the people cannot peacefully cultivate the ground and pestilence, which comes of want, misery, and suffering. Both these horrors broke out in both countries, and lasted for two wretched years. Then, the war went on again, and came by slow degrees, to be so badly conducted by the English government, that, within 20 years from the execution of the Maid of Orleans, of all the great French conquests, the town of Calais alone remained in English hands. While these victories and defeats were taking place in the course of time, many strange things happened at home. The young king, as he grew up, proved to be very unlike his great father, and showed himself a miserable puny creature. There was no harm in him, he had a great aversion to shedding blood. Which was something, but, he was a weak, silly, helpless young man, and a mere shuttlecock to the great lordly battledores about the court. Of these battledores, Cardinal Beaufort, a relation of the king, and the Duke of Gloucester, were at first the most powerful. The Duke of Gloucester had a wife, who was nonsensically accused of practicing witchcraft, to cause the king's death and lead to her husband's coming to the throne, he being the next heir. She was charged with having, by the help of a ridiculous old woman named Marjorie who was called a witch, made a little waxen doll in the king's likeness, and put it before a slow fire, that it might gradually melt away. It was supposed, in such cases, that the death of the person whom the doll was made to represent, was sure to happen. Whether the Duchess was as ignorant as the rest of them, and really did make such a doll with such an intention, I don't know. But, you and I know very well, that she might have made 1,000 dolls, if she had been stupid enough, and might have melted them all, without hurting the king or anybody else. However, she was tried for it, and so was old Marjorie, and so was one of the Duke's chaplains, who was charged with having assisted them. Both he and Marjorie were put to death, and the Duchess, after being taken on foot and bearing a lighted candle, 3 times round the city, as a penance, was imprisoned for life. The Duke, himself, took all this pretty quietly, and made as little stir about the matter, as if he were rather glad to be rid of the Duchess. But, he was not destined to keep himself out of trouble long. The royal shuttlecock being 23, the battledores were very anxious to get him married. The Duke of Gloucester wanted him to marry a daughter of the Count of Armagnac. But, the Cardinal and the Earl of Suffolk were all for Margaret, the daughter of the King of Sicily, who they knew was a resolute, ambitious woman and would govern the king as she chose. To make friends with this lady, the Earl of Suffolk, who went over to arrange the match, consented to accept her for the king's wife without any fortune, and even to give up the 2 most valuable possessions England then had in France. So, the marriage was arranged, on terms very advantageous to the lady, and Lord Suffolk brought her to England, and she was married at Westminster. On what pretense this queen and her party charged the Duke of Gloucester with high treason within a couple of years, it is impossible to make out, the matter is so confused. But they pretended that the king's life was in danger, and they took the duke prisoner. A fortnight afterwards, he was found dead in bed, they said, and his body was shown to the people, and Lord Suffolk came in for the best part of his estates. You know by this time how strangely liable state prisoners were to sudden death. If Cardinal Beaufort had any hand in this matter, it did him no good, for he died within 6 weeks, thinking it very hard, and curious at 80 years old, that he could not live to be Pope. This was the time when England had completed her loss of all her great French conquests. The people charged the loss principally upon the Earl of Suffolk, now a duke, who had made those easy terms about the royal marriage, and who, they believed, had even been bought by France. So he was impeached as a traitor, on a great number of charges, but chiefly on accusations of having aided the French king, and of designing to make his own son King of England. The commons and the people being violent against him, the king was made, by his friends, to interpose to save him, by banishing him for 5 years, and proroguing the parliament. The duke had much ado to escape from a London mob, 2,000 strong, who lay in wait for him in St. Giles' Fields, but he got down to his own estates in Suffolk, and sailed away from Ipswich. Sailing across the channel, he sent in to Calais to know if he might land there, but they kept his boat and men in the harbor until an English ship, carrying 150 men, and called the Nicholas of the Tower, came alongside his little vessel, and ordered him on board. "Welcome, traitor, as men say," apostrophe was the captain's grim, and not very respectful salutation. He was kept on board, a prisoner, for 8 and 40 hours, and then a small boat appeared rowing toward the ship. As this boat came near, it was seen to have in it a block, a rusty sword, and an executioner in a black mask. The duke was handed down into it, and there his head was cut off with 6 strokes of the rusty sword. Then, the little boat rowed away to Dover Beach, where the body was cast out, and left until the Duchess claimed it. By whom, high in authority, this murder was committed, has never appeared. No one was ever punished for it. There now arose in Kent an Irishman, who gave himself the name of Mortimer, but whose real name was Jack Cade. Jack, in imitation of Wat Tyler, though he was a very different and inferior sort of man, addressed the Kentish men upon their wrongs, occasioned by the bad government of England, among so many battledores and such a poor shuttlecock, and the Kentish men rose up to the number of 20,000. Their place of assembly was Blackheath, where, headed by Jack, they put forth 2 papers, which they called the Complaint of the Commons of Kent, apostrophe and the Requests of the Captain of the Great Assembly in Kent, apostrophe. They then retired to Sevenoaks. The royal army coming up with them here, they beat it, and killed their general. Then, Jack dressed himself in the dead general's armor, and led his men to London. Jack passed into the city from Southwark, over the bridge, and entered it in triumph, giving the strictest orders to his men not to plunder. Having made a show of his forces there, while the citizens looked on quietly, he went back into Southwark in good order, and passed the night. Next day, he came back again, having got hold in the meantime of Lord Say, an unpopular nobleman. Says Jack to the Lord Mayor and judges, "Will you be so good as to make a tribunal in Guildhall, and try me this nobleman?" Apostrophe apostrophe The court being hastily made, he was found guilty, and Jack and his men cut his head off on Cornhill. They also cut off the head of his son-in-law, and then went back in good order to Southwark again. But, although the citizens could bear the beheading of an unpopular lord, they could not bear to have their houses pillaged. And it did so happen that Jack, after dinner perhaps he had drunk a little too much, began to plunder the house where he lodged, upon which, of course, his men began to imitate him. Wherefore, the Londoners took counsel with Lord Scales, who had 1,000 soldiers in the Tower, and defended London Bridge, and kept Jack and his people out. This advantage gained, it was resolved by divers great men, to divide Jack's army in the old way, by making a great many promises on behalf of the state, that were never intended to be performed. This did divide them, some of Jack's men saying, that they ought to take the conditions which were offered, and others saying, that they ought not, for they were only a snare, some going home at once, others staying where they were, and all doubting and quarreling among themselves. Jack, who was in two minds about fighting or accepting a pardon, and who indeed did both, saw at last that there was nothing to expect from his men, and that it was very likely some of them would deliver him up, and get a reward of 1,000 marks, which was offered for his apprehension. So, after they had travelled, and quarrelled all the way from Southwark to Blackheath, and from Blackheath to Rochester, he mounted a good horse and galloped away into Sussex. But, there galloped after him, on a better horse, one Alexander Iden, who came up with him, had a hard fight with him, and killed him. Jack's head was set aloft on London Bridge, with the face looking towards Blackheath, where he had raised his flag, and Alexander Iden got the 1,000 marks. It is supposed by some, that the Duke of York, who had been removed from a high post abroad through the Queen's influence, and sent out of the way, to govern Ireland, was at the bottom of this rising of Jack and his men, because he wanted to trouble the government. He claimed, though not yet publicly, to have a better right to the throne than Henry of Lancaster, as one of the family of the Earl of March, whom Henry IV had set aside. Touching this claim, which, being through female relationship, was not according to the usual descent, it is enough to say that Henry IV was the free choice of the people and the Parliament, and that his family had now reigned undisputed for 60 years. The memory of Henry V was so famous, and the English people loved it so much, that the Duke of York's claim would, perhaps, never have been thought of. It would have been so hopeless, but for the unfortunate circumstance of the present king's being by this time quite an idiot, and the country very ill-governed. These two circumstances gave the Duke of York a power he could not otherwise have had. Whether the Duke knew anything of Jack Cade, or not, he came over from Ireland, while Jack's head was on London Bridge, being secretly advised that the Queen was setting up his enemy, the Duke of Somerset, against him. He went to Westminster, at the head of 4,000 men, and on his knees before the King, represented to him the bad state of the country, and petitioned him to summon a Parliament to consider it. This the King promised. When the Parliament was summoned, the Duke of York accused the Duke of Somerset, and the Duke of Somerset accused the Duke of York, and, both in and out of Parliament, the followers of each party were full of violence and hatred towards the other. At length the Duke of York put himself at the head of a large force of his tenants, and, in arms, demanded the reformation of the government. Being shut out of London, he encamped at Dartford, and the royal army encamped at Blackheath. According as either side triumphed, the Duke of York was arrested, or the Duke of Somerset was arrested. The trouble ended, for the moment, in the Duke of York renewing his oath of allegiance, and going in peace to one of his own castles. Half a year afterwards the Queen gave birth to a son, who was very ill received by the people, and not believed to be the son of the king. It shows the Duke of York, to have been a moderate man, unwilling to involve England in new troubles, that he did not take advantage of the general discontent at this time, but really acted for the public good. He was made a member of the cabinet, and the king being now so much worse, that he could not be carried about, and shown to the people with any decency, the duke was made Lord Protector of the kingdom, until the king should recover, or the prince should come of age. At the same time the Duke of Somerset was committed to the Tower. So, now the Duke of Somerset was down, and the Duke of York was up. By the end of the year, however, the king recovered his memory and some spark of sense, upon which the queen used her power which recovered with him to get the protector disgraced, and her favorite released. So now the Duke of York was down, and the Duke of Somerset was up. These dussel ups and downs gradually separated the whole nation into the two parties of York and Lancaster, and led to those terrible civil wars long known as the Wars of the Red and White Roses. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.